He was an immigrant from Yugoslavia. He was from Bosnia, a Muslim. He couldn't practice his religion, unfortunately. He came over in about 1912. And I guess by nature, I didn't know my father well. He left my mother real early, there were five of us, and my mother raised him. I had some contact with him. And in fact, I wish I knew more about his history. He became, he worked in the steel mill for a very short period in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. And then he migrated over to western Pennsylvania, wound up in probably the largest mine in western Pennsylvania. It was in Harmerville, and I was born about 4 or 5 miles away from there. And he obviously was active. Like I said, I had very little contact with him, except I guess I have his genes. And he eventually became what is known as the Czech Wayman in that era, which would be equivalent to the president of a local union. But they called it the Czech Wayman, and this mine had about 5,000 workers. It was giant, it was underground. And the Czech Wayman was the most important job in the mines, because the employers would cheat the guys. They were immigrants. Most of them were uneducated. My father was uneducated, but naturally he probably was pretty smart. And he would check the scales with the management when the coal was brought out, you know, in the little carts after they shoveled it. And that was the number one job, the check weighman, they called him. And that led him to more activity. He became associated with a gentleman who was the vice president of the mine workers at that time, Philip Murray, when John L. Lewis was president. And they became associates because they had the same interest. There was a long strike when the mine companies decided to cut wages in 27 and 29. We're going way back. And it was a 2-year strike, and my father was strike captain in western Pennsylvania. And one of my first lines when I made thousands of speeches, but they were primarily to encourage people to join unions. So like I said, I've never talked about myself, and I had to do a lot of reflecting before I came here. But one of my favorite lines was, and you've all heard the phrase, born with a silver spoon in your mouth. You know, that's a common phrase. I was born with a picket sign in my mouth. that's a fact. I was born in 1929 at the end of the strike. He became blackballed. Two of my older brother, I'm the youngest in the family, and my brother's 2 years older than me. He's still alive in his good health. My sister's just turned 90, and she's in a nursing home. She's not in good condition. But my oldest brother and sister, and he was born in 1921, they were born in what they called the barracks. The companies owned the homes in the mining town of Harmerville, and they evicted the union activists, and they set up tents alongside the river. So that's where two of my oldest brother and sister were born, out in tents of the river. I lived in about 3 different homes because, he was blackballed. And then finally, the big day came in 1936 when John L. Lewis rebelled against the AFL and formed the CIO, the Congress Industrial Organizations. And Philip Murray, then the vice president of the mine workers under John L. Lewis, was assigned to head the Steelworkers Organizing Committee in 1936. And there were others. There was the Auto Workers Organizing Committee, and there were a few other small ones, but those were the major ones. And there was a major Southern organizing drive in the late 30s. And my father was one of the first organizers hired by Philip Murray in 1936. And the one thing I remember about him, we lived on a farm. We was renting it in about 10 miles north of Pittsburgh, little community called Allison Park, and there was a small privately owned mine there, a little community called Wildwood. And it was a friendly employer. He respected and accepted the unionization. And my father went to work there for a while because one of the conditions of working for the, I don't know about all unions, but for the Steelworkers Union, you had to be employed in the industry and you had to be a member of the union and this put him at least in the mine workers because he was expelled. He couldn't keep up his membership, but he worked for a few weeks just to get his membership. And he went on, he was involved in many of the major campaigns, starting 36 and the Union officially, and that's where I met your good professor here in Cleveland. They officially had their 70th anniversary as an official organization. They were an organizing committee from 1936 to 1942, and there was a 70th anniversary, and I'm a retiree, of course, and all the retirees were invited. And when we leave here, I have behind here copies of the Steel Workers magazine that was put together for this occasion. If you haven't seen it, help yourself to a copy. It's a good history of the Steel Workers Union and gives you an idea of the labor movement in general. They did an outstanding job. There's copies back here, John.
Do you want?
Yeah, I do. Thank you. After I got out of high school, and I wasn't the best student, I was a good student when I was in grade school, and high school was fun and games for me. So I struggled to get a diploma primarily, and a lot of my friends didn't finish high school, primarily at the request of my mother, of course, whom I respected dearly. She hoped that I would get a high school diploma, and I did. And I did what most of the my friends and the students that graduated in that area. I first was hired at the Pittsburgh Plate Glass Company, which was represented by the glass workers, Local 12. I still have that card, and I can't find it, 1947. I worked there for a couple years, and we got laid off a lot. They supplied windshields for Chrysler, and the glass manufacturing for auto went up and down with the auto industry. And I was laid off on and off a lot. And finally, the layoff looked permanently after a year or two. And believe it or not, and maybe this is not important to you, but I got married on the spur of the moment in 1951. We just eloped. And, my wife had shorts on and a t-shirt when we got married in North Carolina. That was the first place you didn't have to have a blood test. I'm not setting you a good example here, but I have to be honest with you.
I'd like to wait till you got back home and don't do
that in D.C. Right, at least.
I'll use that as an example of what you're going to do while you're visiting.
I'll tell you, the plus side, we celebrated our 61st anniversary last month, so that tells you something that it worked and gives you something to shoot for, a real high bar for you, for your generation to shoot for. Right. My father contacted me, and he said that they're doing some hiring in Central Iron and Steel in Harrisburg. He lived in Harrisburg, and that's central Pennsylvania. So when I got hired, when you go into a manufacturing plant, a major one, the Pittsburgh Plate Plant, we had about 4,000 members, employees there, and then Allegheny Ludlum Steel, I lived right above it, about five or six blocks. In fact, the smoke would come up, and my mother died at cancer throughout her system, and I often wonder with the smoke that came up. We were right on top of that mill. I applied there, but I didn't get hired. So I was able to get hired at the Central Iron and Steel. It was a rolling mill. They brought in the big ingots and they reheated them, rolled them into big sheets for the ships. I worked there for a couple years, probably about a year and a half, and starting to raise a family, and my father said that they're looking for, they want to inject some youth into the CIO, and he wanted to know if I was interested. I said, well, I can't do any worse than I am now, you know, just struggling, working in the labor gang, and pushing wheelbarrows, and I had the steel mill. So I got this opportunity, and I took advantage of it, not consciously. You know, I was 21 or 22 years old. But by nature, I took my assignments seriously. In fact, I'm going to send John a bill. I had to work a couple of hours last night to put these notes again. I'm just teasing you.
Oh, that's fine.
No, I'm teasing you. I've done this before, but in a different setting. In fact, one of my enjoyments was I spoke to students probably in 8 or 10 universities around the country. And I did have a condition, but I didn't bother you because I'm retired. I asked for one of their seals, and I used to have them on my wall in the office. In fact, I got one here I'm gonna show you while we're talking about it.
We have a gift for you.
Okay, well, that's fine.
For a little later, but it does have the MSU
very
logo
good.
On it.
Very good.
We did bring that
well,
to
I,
give you.
It would be sort of obsolete. This is my first one. You can pass that around. I had the pleasure of attending, I'm a little ahead of myself, but I'll mention this since we're talking about SEALs. I had the pleasure of participating in a three-week exchange program with the British Trade Union at Oxford. So that was a great experience, and unfortunately I was a couple days late and I missed something. My father died right at that time, at the beginning of it, and I had a tough decision to make whether I should stay out of respect. And this was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, but that was the beginning of my collection of the steel. So
this was a British Steel Union that was doing something at Oxford University.
Right, and a group of them came here, and this group was primarily auto workers, because Walter Reuther organized it, and he called IWA and said, would you like to send somebody from the steel workers? There were about a half a dozen unions there, but dominated by UAW. In fact, I got a picture of it. If we meet, you want to meet again, I'll bring the picture. You remember the rebel director that went out to California, the young, tall guy from the UAW and became director in California with a thorn in Reuther's side. Do you remember him?
I can't remember the name off the top of
my head. He was with us.
Okay.
So I wound up starting to work for the CIO in September of 1991. I was assigned to the northeastern part of Pennsylvania. And our prime role, the CIO staff, there were about 100 of us, was to assist the unions, primarily the smaller unions. The bigger unions didn't need help. And I remember my first assignment, we had an organizing campaign among insurance workers. And you might find it hard to believe that there was an Insurance Workers International Union. The Metropolitan Insurance Agents, that's the one that used to go door to door to collect the premiums. They were all organized, and the Metropolitan was an anti-union, and then Prudential was the next big one, and you know, 5,000-10,000 agents, and that was the assignment to work on the Prudential agents in Northeast, and we finally got a majority assigned. The company agreed to recognize the union if they produced a majority. We didn't have to go through these vicious elections, and I helped other unions there, and then I had an interesting assignment. It was in fact, my career is varied, I can tell you this. You won't find one like it, and don't try to follow me. Find what you like, a good career, and stick with it so you can specialize in it and become expert and move up in your career. In 1949, the CIO expelled 11 unions with 1 million members. The CIO at that time had about 6 million members. And they expelled them because their leadership was really committed to communism, and they were moving to the left. In fact, my belief is that Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal saved America from some form of ism. That's what I believe. We were moving in that direction. People were hungry, you know, 20, 30 million unemployed. And where do you go? Desperate. And a group of them took control of a bunch of the unions, and the largest one was the electrical union with 600,000 members. Well, after they called a special convention, and I think this was in Cleveland too, in 1949, and they went through the democratic process. The unions are democratic. They're run from the bottom up. The officials are elected, the local union officers are elected, and they expelled the 11 unions. It was obvious, they didn't hide it. They were promoting a form of communism in America. But the CIO set up counter unions, or if there were smaller unions, they assigned their jurisdiction to another union. And the mass of members came back pretty quickly into the CIO unions that were set up. But there was a hardcore in the Midwest, in Chicago and the Quad Cities. And in 1953, probably, 52 or 53, Walter Reuther again, he was our great leader, John L. Lewis, Walter Reuther, and Philip Murray were my idols and my leaders. He convinced the Electrical Workers Union, the IUE now, which got the bulk of the old communist group in the 600,000, they probably got three-quarters of them that move over and affiliated. They went through the proper procedures. But there was a hardcore in Chicago of the United Electric Workers, and there was a hardcore in the Quad Cities, Davenport, you know. And I was assigned to that program. I think there were about 30 of us. The UAW assigned 10 organizers. The Union of IUE, International Electric, assigned 10, and CIO assigned 10. And I brought my wife out. We got an apartment right on the west side in Chicago, and I had a couple of experiences there, but I won't have personal experiences. Before I was able to get my wife and get the apartment, I stayed at a Midwest hotel, and it rings a bell, and that was Capone headquarters. And one of the brothers would be in the bar there once a time when I stopped in. But I spent a couple months in Chicago. We were trying to get to the leadership of the expelled unions. And then I was assigned to Moline, the Quad Cities, where there was a hardcore of what we called FE, farm equipment. There was a farm equipment workers union also in the CIO. And their jurisdiction was assigned to the auto workers, which made sense because it was the automobile, agricultural implement and aerospace, and that was a part of their jurisdiction. And let me say it was a sobering experience. We lost 22 elections and we never won any in that effort, and it was folded after a couple of years, but it's good too. You have to have losses in life, believe me. It doesn't go straight up. You hope that it goes pretty steady, but sometimes it gets down and you got to be prepared and you got to bounce back. Eventually, and I sort of lost track of it, I returned to northeastern Pennsylvania, and eventually UAW did pick them all up. They arranged for an affiliation with the leadership. The Chicago ones, I know there was a remnant of the UE when I was still working. In fact, I tried to convince them to join the steelworkers. I got to know them through collective bargaining. I don't know what they're doing today. This was pretty much the end of my career in the CIO. It was about 5 years. The merger of the AFL-CIO took place in 1955. I had the pleasure of attending that convention in New York City. And there were some real serious questions about what's going to happen to the staff. You know, with the merger, the AFL had about 10 million members, and the CIO at that time had about 5 million members. And we knew they were going to dominate, but the CIO people knew it was the right thing to have one labor movement. And again, Walter Reuther was leading us at that time in that direction. And there was doubts. We didn't know. So again, I was able to transfer to the steelworker staff. That's when I did in 1956, full time. And I was assigned to the Philadelphia area. It was our District 7. It was the second or third largest district. I think we had 80,000 members in the district at that time. Covered southeastern Pennsylvania, southern Jersey, and all of Delaware. And I worked there from 1956 to 1963. We did a lot of organizing, primarily small units. The largest one that I remember was a plant called Nice Ball Bearing. They made ball bearings. There were about 600 workers. And there was sort of a little ball bearing center in Philly. There was a large Swedish plant called SKF. I don't know if they're still around. Represented by Stewart, we had 2,500 members. There was one of our good progressive locals. So there was a relationship. But when I left, and I may have those records, John. I have a lot of records. I have a bunch of scrapbooks and records.
I've been talking about I know some historians and archives.
They tell me the Penn State program is going downhill. I talked to somebody. The steelworkers used to support it financially, and I guess they don't anymore for financial reasons. But as I recall, my goal was to try to get at least one bargaining unit organized a month, and of course I had help. In fact, three or four staff guys owe their job to our work down there. The director would hire new staff as we organized new people to service them, as your father did. And I think we organized about 80 units from that period, from the 1956 to 1963. And again, in 1963, another sort of minor revolution happened in the American labor movement. Walter Reuther got a pledge from the AFL at the time of the merger of the AFL-CIO in 1955 to put on a major organizing campaign. That was our interest. You got to organize. It's like a company. You got to have a good sales force. If you can't organize, bring in new members, you'll disappear eventually. And some of it's happened to a lot of the unions. A lot of the small unions, in my view, had no right to exist. It became personal issues. Walter Reuther and I guess some associates drafted what they called a comprehensive coordinated organizing program. And he had convinced the, I missed a point, an important step here. At the time of the merger, the CIO got an agreement from the AFL that in order to maintain the identity of CIO, they would establish a department, an autonomous department in the AFL-CIO. It was called the Industrial Union Department. And Walter Reuther was the president of that Industrial Union Department, also president of the auto workers. And he devised and organized and convinced the old CIO unions, which were the industrial division of the AFL-CIO, to set up a organizing drive, not nationwide, pretty much east of the Mississippi, because it couldn't handle it financially. And the unions made a commitment to contribute $1 a year in cash or in kind. And I remember the steelworkers gave about $1 million, you know, it was on a monthly basis. And
$1 a year per member.
Per member, yeah, excuse me. Yeah, thank you, John. $1 a year per member. And we had a kitty of $2 or $3 million and staff, and five areas were designated: the state of Texas, Southeast United States, the Mid-Atlantic, Boston, and Chicago. And people were asked to coordinate those efforts, and I was asked to coordinate the Mid-Atlantic. So that's where I went back again, not the CIO anymore, but the old CIO. And I spent, 1963 to 1968. That was about a five-year period. Again, exhaustion set in, money, you know, keeping badgering. But we had probably, in those five efforts, about 200 organizers. We had about 30 in Philadelphia. And about 20 unions participated, and we had success. I remember I sent a report to I.W. Abel, and I was trying to find it. And we were involved in about 170 bargaining units organizing and covering about 30,000 to 35,000 employees, and we won about 80% of them. So it's a good record. And there was another development in my career, and I hope this happens to all of you. I had a real exciting career when I look back. There was a vicious inter-union fight for the leadership of the Steelworkers Union, about 1968, I'm thinking, 67 or 68. And I got involved because I was uncomfortable with the leadership. We had a president by the name of David McDonald, a smart guy, but his ambition in life was to become a movie actor. I'm serious. He was a tall, handsome, good-looking guy, and he was pretty well entrenched, even though I know, which is not known publicly, the current president at the time, Philip Murray, died suddenly on the way to, I was driving to the convention, I was in Denver, in San Francisco. He was in his mid-60s, a heart attack. And David McDonald, for your information, because you appreciate that, wasn't his first choice. But he was able to maneuver and held on to the spot for a while, did a pretty good job, but his heart wasn't in the labor movement. So eventually his secretary treasurer, a gentleman by the name of I.W. Abel, decided to run against him. And if you want to see a political campaign that can be rough, see an inter-union campaign, because we're all organizers, you follow me. And I followed the rules, you know, under the government rules, labor management rules. I did it on my own time. I was able to convince, we had a staff of about 35 in the steelworkers, that district there. I convinced four or five of the organizers to go with me. course, the director, who was my friend, was very, very upset and attacked me viciously. In fact, I remember we didn't have much money. It was a Howard Johnson's. We rented a room. That was our office in King of Prussia, right off Valley Forge. And a few years later, I was told, and this is another tip for you guys, if you get in the, again, if you get in the leadership position, he had a tape recording in our office for the whole time we were there. I was shocked, but that gives you an idea how things went. Eventually, IWA was elected by 10,000 votes, and I held my, the president of Steelworkers, you know, I held my breath because I was out of a job. In fact, John, I'm sure, is familiar with the Labor Relations Act. What was it? What do we call it? The New Jersey Senator? The Labor Management Act?
McClellan?
No. Landrum Griffin. Yeah, you're Michigan guy. Yeah, Landrum Griffin. I think I'm in name, and I got to check it in the first case they held. I think Dave McDonald filed a charge against me. And claiming that, you know, I violated the law by campaigning, and it never went anywhere. They made a settlement out of it. But that led to the new president of Steelworkers asking me to set up an organizing department for the Steelworkers Union, which I did in 1968. I left the industrial operation in the Philadelphia area. And I went to Pittsburgh, and this was the Steelworkers never had an official organizing department. It was the responsibility of all the districts. And it was a great challenge. And I started out with a small staff, eventually had about 20 or 30 staff people. And of course, my prime job was to encourage the organizing. I couldn't get involved too much personally, although I did, because it was just my nature. As I remember the first couple of days I was there, I met with the vice president, and he said, I want to give you a tip. He said, you're an organizer, you're going to be running around in circles. He said, your job is here, to be available for the president. Don't forget that. But I did go out in the field quite a bit and get involved in some campaigns, even personally. But we did well in that area as a union. I didn't see it then. You'll probably be the same way. It's hard to see your progress until long after, and sometimes it's hard to see your failure still long after in life. That's the way it works. But in hindsight, we did very well. I pulled the figures together, how to make annual reports and reports to the convention. And I don't have the number of the bargaining units. I couldn't find. I have it somewhere at home because I put a bio together when I was on my next job. And I do recall the bargaining units that we organized in the steelworkers for that period from 1968 to 1979 covered about 250,000 potential members. And I do recall also that we reached our peak. I had a close contact with the Secretary of Treasury's office because I used to help pick some of the local union numbers. I picked the one at Newport News, 8888. That was my favorite number. And I had close contact with Walter Burke, you know the name Walter Burke. And we reached our peak then. The steelworkers had 29 million, right short of 1.3 million. That was our peak. I remember that vividly.
So 1,300,000.
Yeah, right.
Members.
Cut short. Yeah. Dues paying.
Dues paying. Members.
Yeah, and the UAW was still the largest. I think they were close to 1.6 at that time.
And what year was this again?
That would be 1979, roughly.
1979.
Yeah. So then the the gates crashed and everything went down in manufacturing. I was in 1979 as a result. Well, I had a couple other jobs with the steelworkers that impacted my future. I was also charged by the president with the responsibility of handling our affairs and disputes with all the other unions in the AFL-CIO, all the other 100 unions, and there were a lot of them. We had Article 20 charges, which is machinery in the AFL-CIO to settle disputes between unions. Which we'd call, the intra-union disputes.
Two different unions both want to organize a group of workers, and so do they just fight it against each other, or do you have some rules And so the labor movement, the unions and the AFL-CIO said, we don't want everybody spending a lot of money wastefully trying to compete to organize a group of workers. We'd like to have some mechanism to decide that just one union focusing on that group of workers. And so
that mechanism is there, Article 20, the AFL-CIO Constitution. And we had other types of disputes too, you know, in the plant with the craft unions. So I spent quite a bit of time, and I made a lot of friends in the labor movement. And I occasionally got involved in special projects. In fact, I was in the home state of some of you Michiganers here for a couple months. The steelworkers were involved in the largest and longest strike in the chemical industry at Dow Chemical in Midland. It went for 6 months, and there was no end in sight, and the president sent me up to see if I could help settle it. And I spent a couple months there, and we did settle it. It was difficult, compromising, the local union negotiating, about a dozen. You know, there's political issues. This is a big local, 6,000. It came in with a merger. I'll mention that briefly, District 50 merger. And the local union officers, you know, they're politicians too. They got to get elected periodically. Went back and forth. I got involved in negotiations, got involved with the employer attorney. And finally we come to what I thought was an acceptable deal, and I took it to the negotiating committee. And we had a slight majority, but there was one condition that I had to present it to the body, which I did. There was a couple thousand at the meeting, and it was ratified. But that was just, as I said, I had some special projects. On two occasions, I took a leave of absence. I coordinated IWA's re-election campaign for the President Steelworkers Union. And then we had a tough inter-union fight in Chicago, our largest district. Joe Germano, I don't know if that rings a bell to you. And there was a the potential incumbent when Germano passed away. In fact, he lost an election, and there was a rerun, and they asked me to go in to see if I could turn it around. He lost 3-1, and they asked me to go in to see if I could turn it around. I went, opened up a motel in Gary, spent a couple of months there. I went to local 1010, you know, Gary and Inland Steel. Those are the big powerhouses, 10,000-15,000 members. And we got
one
a pretty
local union at that time that had that many employees.
Yeah, 15,000. Yeah, we had a during the war, we had a local in the Philadelphia area that had 30,000 members. And it was the old train engine manufacturer, the original. They start making war equipment, you know, tanks and that stuff. And then at Bethlehem Steel in the Baltimore area, we had two locals with 30,000 members. It's pretty hard to conceive. It's like a town, you follow me.
One thing I just want to fill in, because there's no way.
Please do.
No.
You know what
I don't want to interrupt
for
you, but.
No, you can't.
But when an employer is unionized, okay, and it could be through an election, like we talked about with the National Labor Relations Board, or as was mentioned here, the employer could decide, I'm not going to contest that the union does represent the majority of my employees. So you end up that the union's recognized either by the government or by the employer is going to be the union for that group of employees. The union leadership then has some process. As you mentioned, there's some federal laws that regulate internal union procedures to try to make them more democratic. Some members have some rights to choose leaders. But there's also the issue the union then negotiates a contract, and you have some kind of group, a bargaining committee selected or elected, who negotiate with the employer's human resource department, or in the old days they were called personnel departments, on what's going to be in the contract. What are the wages going to be? Are there going to be pensions? Is there any health care? Is there any time off? And back in the 30s, 40s, 50s, these contracts used to be smaller, and they were much less elaborate, because many things weren't covered yet. You didn't have in the old days health care and pensions and dental care and eye care and all that. That comes much later. But what he was describing was, so when he went to Midland, Michigan to help out that local union, he helped the union's bargaining committee negotiate with Dow Chemical. But then the union has to get its members to agree that what they negotiated is what they want.
They vote on it, the final word.
And that's what ratifying meant. So the union leadership first negotiates with the employer, here's what we want, but then they have to sell their own members on, this is as good a deal as we can negotiate. And sometimes that's even more difficult than negotiating with the employer, awesome. Because the employees have expectations of, why shouldn't I get lots and lots more money than that? Why shouldn't we have as good of benefits as a union has at another factory in another town? Those kind of expectations. And so that's what you were...
I thank you, and I apologize if I spoke a little bit above you guys. I'm going to finish in a couple minutes, and you ask any kind of questions you have.
I just wanted to get that out.
No, it's important, because you know their level. I don't know their level of...
You wouldn't, and my grad students wouldn't necessarily realize that. Okay. It's nothing about the level, but it's just sometimes people don't realize that for a union leadership, it's both dealing with the employer, but it's also dealing with your members. And so sometimes you talk about you're really negotiating both directions, because it's, we all have our thoughts. And if somebody asks me, do you want to vote on getting $10 an hour or $12 an hour, in the abstract, well, of course I'll vote, I want $12 an hour. Well, are you willing to go out and strike for it? Or are you willing to get $12 an hour in pay and not have as many holidays? What's the trade-offs? And the union bargaining committee makes these trade-offs with the employer, but members might have different feelings, and then you get into intra-union fights because somebody else says, well, if we had been at the table, we would have done more for you. I just wanted to add that.
Well, that's what the Republicans are saying now about the current administration.
And we'll get to that in a second, but I just wanted to add to that.
No, that's a must. Yeah, like I said, these are your students, these are your friends, and you're with them, and you get the understanding. But I'm going to wrap up in a couple minutes. The last organizing campaign I was involved in was very significant again, and I personally directed it. And I brought a couple momentas to show you here. I'm not a braggart, but John said I could bring a few things with me. It was a Newport News shipyard. It's a very long, complicated case, and a young lady is doing her dissertation on the situation. I met with her a couple of weeks ago. But just to tell you that it was probably the largest private sector bargaining unit I know organized in the last 30, 40 years, and possibly in the history. There are big public employee units have been organized in New York City and California. But as I even recall, we got an eligibility list, and there were 19,228 on the list. I remember that. And we were successful in that election. It had what we call a company union, an independent union that the employer formed. In the early 30s, the employers, when they saw the wave of unionism coming as a result of depression, they set up their own unions. We called them company unions. They called them employee representative plans. And that's what they had at the shipyard for many years. Couple unions tried to organize them, the machinists, the shipbuilders, the iron workers, and we put on a successful campaign, and unfortunately that ended my career in the steelworkers union, in a sense, because as I went to the Cleveland, John, I knew very few people there. It was really sort of sad in a way, but I'm glad I met you there. It made it worthwhile. And I spent from 1979 to 1996, I was elected Secretary Treasurer of this Industrial Union Department. We were headquartered in Washington, the AFL-CIO building, and I served that for a dozen years, and then I left as the President of the Department. So I went the full circle, and that was again the old CIO. And when you're an officer in a union, you're really a jack of all trades. You have to do everything. You know, you go up the hill, you legislate, you campaign, you try to help affiliates. Like I said, I held about every job in the labor movement. My love was organizing, it really moved my career. It wasn't a conscious effort. I didn't know about it, but it moved my career along. I did have one regret leaving, John. I always try to do the impossible. I established a campaign in the DuPont plants, and that was the holdout in manufacturing. DuPont had about 50, 60, and they had all company unions. I was making headway there, and then it sort of fell by the wayside when I left. And one regret that I, not a regret, I guess I shouldn't say regret, one of the major things that I felt that I did in the, as an officer of the Industrial Union Department, was try unsuccessfully, and I hope that the effort never ends, to get legislation passed to prevent employers from bringing in strike breakers during a strike. And I am the strongest advocate of strikes in America, and there's a reason for it. Our system won't work. It'll eventually collapse. If workers don't have the right to stand up to express themselves on a job, I believe that strongly. It may endure for a long time, but we all know under the dictatorships everywhere, Germany, Italy, they crushed the unions first, because the unions were democratic organizations that would speak up and argue with them. And whittling away at the right to strike, which they were able to do, starting with the great communicator, Ronald Reagan, by firing the air traffic controllers, set the example for the employers. So we've had a lot of, we've had our strikes, but they've been difficult, and the employer can convince workers to go back to work and cross a picket line. And we made a yeoman's effort along with the AFL-CIO to get the S-55. In fact, I talked to President Clinton personally about it indirectly at a reception, and he assured me he was doing everything he could. We felt 2 votes short. You need 68 in the Senate. I mean, 60 in the Senate to get anything passed to avoid a filibuster. We got to get rid of that rule too. We need a simple majority. We're a democracy. We believe in simple majority rules. We felt, and one was in President Clinton's home state, one of the senators. And he couldn't sway him around. It didn't succeed, but it, to me, it was a meaningful effort. And I hope in your generation, in the coming years, that you defend the right to strike. It's really the worker's right to hold back, is not to be a slave. It's that simple. If you do not have the right to hold back your labor, and if you do not put your conditions of work in writing in a contract, indirectly you're a slave. You're at the mercy of the employer. He can do whatever he wants to do. Give you what he wants to do, hire what he wants to do. There are no laws and no rules that said an employer can't fire you. There are no laws, no rules anywhere. And that's the ultimate weapon that the American workers and all workers around the world have. And there's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing wrong with it. It's democracy in action. And to me, unionization is democracy on a job, and I'm going to shut my mouth. Apologize for talking about it too much.
That was wonderful. Thank you. I'm going to push you back.
Go ahead.
So for almost 20 years, you were in D.C.?
Right, 17. I've been living there 30 years now. I'm still there.
Okay. So part of what you did was working on that one bill, kind of lobbying or helping draft it?
Both. The AFL-CIO itself helped draft. It was a simple bill. Lobbying a lot, bringing in cases. You know, we build a big and pass it out to all the Senate cases where strike breakers were brought in, you know, the end result, which was often disaster. And
I think I mentioned it to you briefly. One of the things we have on a busy Monday's agenda is we're going to spend a couple hours at the AFL-CIO building, which is a large building just north of the Capitol. Kind of just north of the Capitol is the Chamber of Commerce's headquarters and the AFL-CIO headquarters.
Yeah, that's where I worked in the AFL-CIO. That was our office.
Okay, so this building we're going to go to Monday, we're going to meet some people, is where he worked for 17 years.
Okay. Yeah.
And during that time, you weren't doing this union organizing, you were doing things related to...
We were promoting organizing. We had a small effort in the South. We kept
right, but you weren't out doing that anymore. You were...
Not personally, I did one campaign.
Right. But now you were
not
helping.
Personally. I was an executive.
Right. You were now
union
executive
boss.
With this organization, and you were helping draft legislation, and you were trying to help push legislation. And we do have some students who are interested in the lobbying process and how lobbying is done. And so a little bit about that would be nice to hear, I think.
It's a good field, lobbying to get into, although I guess there's really an abuse there. John, I can't speak into any fine detail except that first you have to establish yourself, you know, and then you have to establish yourself with the with your clients up in the hill, and that's the key issue. Once you establish yourself, and of course there's lobbying firms, we're loaded with them all around D.C. You try to engage yourself there. Hopefully one of you wind up lobbying with the labor movement. They have a legislative department and a full-time director that heads the lobbying.
So would your bosses sort of suggest this week or this month we're going to have these kind of things, and here's some representatives, or here's some senators, or here's their aides, and you should go talk to them? And
well, we had a legislative director, you know, and that was his responsibility, and you monitor the ongoing legislation and the ones that concern you directly, and you often have a couple of your own pet projects, and this S-55 was one of the pet projects. And the key is to work the hill, to bring people around to your point of view.
So how do you do that?
You knock on the door. You knock on the door. You friends are friends with contacts. You visit them. I've been in many senator and representative's offices, and generally they're all open. You know, they really have to be. They're very accessible, so it's your responsibility. Know your subject, know your issue, and make your pitch and try to convince them. And we often brought people from the field in with us. You know, we brought to give examples of on the issue that we were trying to persuade them on. We would bring workers in from the field. We'd bring workers in to testify. Like I said, it's an interesting profession. I'm personally a little concerned that it's playing too significant a role in our democratic system. That's my own personal view, because money talks, and that's what's happening here. And if you want a good lucrative career, you might want to chase that if you're successful. It's very interesting, but again, you're usually working for some powerful group, unless you wind up with the union. Go ahead, brother.
With the merger of the AFL-CIO, that was huge.
Yes, it was, 1955.
So was there any opposition to it? What were the companies doing, or the employers doing?
Well, the employers didn't like it, but they really couldn't do anything about it. It was an internal union matter. And within the labor movement, everybody was happy. It was something that probably should have never split, but the reason for the split was that the AFL, the craft unions, sort of the aristocrats, didn't believe the workers on the shop floor should have a union. They just didn't believe in it. And then John L. Lewis was really the key guy in the mine workers. He was they were in the AFL. He believed otherwise. And he said, you guys, at a convention, you need to set up a committee and go out and organize these steel workers, these auto workers, the assembly line workers. They're entitled to unions too, and they wouldn't go along with it. So he broke away from the AFL, and seven or eight unions went with him, and then they set up this Congress and the CIO, and we parted from 36 to 55, and then we came back together again in 55. It shouldn't have happened, but it was, I guess, almost a philosophical issue. They just didn't believe that the shop worker should have a union. But again, that was the early stages of the Industrial Revolution. You got to understand that, you follow me. Craft union, the craftsmen were aristocrats.
Now, how did the radical ideas of communism play into the Red Scare in America, and how did that affect unions?
It really didn't catch on. As far as the public was concerned at that time, because America was still coming out of the Depression, and then we entered World War II, which was a tremendous distraction. And the public, it wasn't a public issue. Eventually we had the McCarthy Committee, you know that, John, and that was the witch hunt, you know, for the left-leaning people in America, a lot of them. Ronald Reagan was almost amongst that group. He was the president of the one of the most militant unions in America, the Screen Actors Guild. He was a real good Democrat, left-winger. He's a traitor to us. He flipped completely. I can tell you a story about that if you want to hear it. I had friends in management. You know, I had to work with the employers. You mentioned the Chamber of Commerce. I spoke to their group, a couple of their labor relations group right around the corner. I had a lot of friends in management. The president of Alcoa was a good friend. Somebody mentioned Alcoa here. We had a labor management committee to try to make things better in America. But one of my good friends was a counterpart of John's, Herb Northrup, from the University of Pennsylvania.
Little older.
Yeah. We developed a friendship. I don't know how. He invited me to speak to his industrial labor relations class. I went up a half a dozen times, and we talked, you know, and he knew his role. The employer, he represented management, and I represented unions. And he told me a story about Ronald Reagan was a did commercials for General Electric, probably before your time, you remember him. He did commercials on TV, Ronald Reagan, before he was elected even governor of California. And somebody in GE got the idea to take him around their plants to build up the morale. And GE had a fairly large plant, I'm pretty sure it was in Allentown, Pennsylvania, mostly women. And they took Ronald Reagan there to give him a pep rally, these women. And they said the women went crazy after he spoke. They just went wild. And he said that was the seed that led the leadership of the Republican Party to move him into leadership position. You know, and it was true, you know, in that era.
Like a movie idol or
exactly.
a music star
exactly.
or something like that.
And he did become governor of California. I give him credit for that, but he was a disappointment. But there was no impact as far as, you know, from the public point of view. And television wasn't alive then, and, you know, the communications was minimal. You had your local newspapers. It didn't affect the union from a public point of view.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Do you think that the attacks on labor and unions recently is due to the lack of knowledge of labor history in America?
I agree with that 1,000%. It's unfortunate. And I guess we got to look in the mirror. You know, we always talk about the need to education. The labor movement, even though, you know, we're accused of having billions of dollars, and the labor movement doesn't have much money, you know, when you look at it. You know, it's the dues of the workers. I would be surprised if you totaled all the money, and this is off the top of my head, if you had $100 million, I'd be surprised. And, you know, we're talking about billion-dollar people that we're opposing to, the Cox and those guys that put all this money in the campaign. You're 100% right, and we haven't, and again, I'm removed from the labor movement for a while, and I'm not speaking for the labor movement, please bear that in mind, even though the president is a dear friend of mine, Rich Trumka. That would be the primary reason, and there's another reason, I believe. When I was a youngster in Philadelphia, and we had our little offices, we'd chat, and one of the old-timers, I remember talking to me, and it stuck with me because it was unusual. He said, you know, we're raising the standard of living so high for our members that we're going to lose them. And I think he was right. And what happened is that, you know, millions and millions of Americans, including myself, never made big money. We moved into the middle class and the upper middle class. And I do remember a speech that I think it was the Rhodes, Senator Rhodes from Arizona, made at a AFL-CIO convention years ago. He was a moderate Republican. I'm pretty sure it was Rhodes. And you correct me if I'm wrong. He said, let me start by telling you what a conservative is. He said, a conservative is somebody that has something to conserve. So that's what happened. The middle class had homes and cars. It's something to conserve. So they didn't feel like they had a struggle anymore with their employer. Some of the unions now recognize, and they're out organizing, you know, janitors in the lower class, and the immigrants, which is good, and that's probably the future of the labor movement. You're 100% right there. I'm not making this stuff up. You know, I believe what I've been in my life, and I've had a good life. I've worked for it. It wasn't handed to me. When my wife and I got married, we were $700 in a hole. As I started my career, I had a car, and I owed $700 on it. My father signed for it. So I started out zero, and I have a nice home, educated three daughters. I have eight grandkids. My three daughters, two were teachers, one just retired, and they're all doing real well. And this has happened all around America. So they're concerned about holding on to that stuff now. And then really the employers, this is a long ending fight to keep the unions weak, because they know what will happen. And the unions will not destroy the corporations. They want the workers to get a fair share and fair treatment, that's all. And we've said that over and over again. And by nature, you know, we're all selfish by nature. They're not going to stand up and hand out good wages and good benefits. It's got to be forced out of them. But I don't know how that's a difficult problem. Maybe you guys ought to address it with the AFL-CIO when you go over there. There's no understanding. It was Roosevelt's New Deal that enabled me to get where I am. They established the National Labor Relations Act, which enabled workers to form unions, which enabled workers to bargain collectively with their employers, which enabled unions to help their members raise their standard of living. And also, he helped us. He was probably more responsible in winning World War II, Roosevelt. And the employers know this. The money people know this. They want to protect this. We're a threat to them. If they would open up the book and say unions, responsible unions, democratic unions, are good for our free enterprise system. They got to be responsible. They got to be free, run by the members, and they are. It's good for our system, because to me the biggest weakness in our system, and this is a bad word to say publicly, a distribution of wealth. It's unequal. You remember Joe the plumber? He became a hero because he said that was a bad word. That's socialistic. You want to take my money? The best way to distribute wealth in America, and it's happened so far, is collective bargaining. That's the best way to distribute wealth. Now the employers, like I said, they're smart people. That's why they're billionaires, and they've resisted us from the beginning. That S-55 fight I told you about, eliminating the employer's right to hire strike breakers, we call them scabs, that's the union word for it, to cross picket lines during a strike. They beat us on it. They beat us on it. But it's a never-ending fight. You can't stop the fight. Because maybe not in your lifetime even, but the system will not work if the workers don't have a voice. It won't work.
Elmer, you've got some things on the floor.
Sure.
Here, and we got about 5 minutes
okay.
Before we're going to take the lunch break.
Sure. And like I said, it's not my nature to brag. This is, I'm going to pass that around.
Okay, otherwise we can put them up there, Holly, move that marker.
Either way, well, let them pass them around.
Okay.
That is the official, your daughter would appreciate that, and I was real proud to hear she worked for the board.
Uh-huh.
It was a Baltimore office that ran that campaign.
Oh, okay, and that's the office where she'll work.
Yeah, that's the official certification. After we count the votes, the NLRB, you know, the workers vote, you know, this one went all day, this election, then we sign it. This is the work of the National Labor Relations. This is what his daughter does. When you run an election, at the end of the election, right on the scene, they fill in this form, how many were eligible, who voted for what, and they sign it, and then the party sign it.
And they ran a little election here, and we had 11 possible votes because I didn't vote, and the vote was 6-5 to unionize. So there were 11
I got cards in the car.
In this one that he's got here, that's from 1977,
right.
There were 19,000 eligible
228,
employees.
228, that was, go ahead, I'm kidding you.
And it says here that they count almost 17,000 voted,
right,
of the group, and 9,093 voted for the steel workers, which was Elmer's union, and 7,500, about 1,500 less, voted for Peninsula Shipbuilders Association, which must be an independent or company union.
Company union, right.
And then 95 voted for some other union, the Marine Industrial Union, and 217 said, no, we don't want a union at all.
And that was pleasing. Out of 17,000, only 200 said they didn't want a union. That was real rewarding to me.
So you must have run a good, effective
campaign. Oh, we did. I can, there's a long story. This is the culmination. That was our union paper, you follow me? The next issue after we won the election.
So had these employees, these 19,000, not had a union before at this point?
Well, the independent. The independent.
It was the Peninsula or whatever.
It's back to the 30s.
Okay.
The company set it up in the 30s.
Okay. And they had been there and stayed there.
Yeah, the machinists lost an election, the Boilermakers, and okay. I don't know whether you remember, there was a shipbuilders union at CIO.
So
they tried.
So in the company union, they had contracts, but it's not clear that the employees had much say in what was negotiated, or was it?
No.
Significantly less money or benefits than what otherwise the industry unionized?
They were behind.
Okay.
There were good.
So, I mean, I was curious, what was your pitch to why join the steel
that
workers?
That was a lot of things. Benefits, wages, representation. It was a sweetheart deal.
The old contract.
Okay. Yeah. In fact, there was a long, vicious strike for the first contract.
Okay.
It was a real nasty strike for months. In fact, they wrote a song. I told you I picked the local number. It's local 8888. They wrote a song, Close the Gates, 88, during the strike. I wasn't involved. I had left, and that was a disappointment. But the service reps took over, and there was a real vicious strike with the police and National Guard. And the union prevailed in the end. They got their first contract. They've been there for 30 years now.
And how long did you live in this town? Is it helping work with this campaign, or how did you?
I went back and forth every weekend. I handled the major meetings. You know, would have meetings probably every 2 or 3 weeks, and get down for a staff. We had a half a dozen staff initially when the election was set. We had about 20 staff in there. And we had a major rally. Martin Luther King Sr. was supposed to, as long as I'm talking too much.
No, you're not.
Martin Luther King, we made a special trip. The vice president of the steelworkers happened to be an African American, Leon Lynch. And I told him that we need to get a King here to speak. It was half black, half African American, half white in the shipyard. And we got to get to the African Americans. And I called Coretta King in Atlanta, and she was unavailable, but I found out later that there was a sense that the employer might have gotten to her indirectly. So I said, let's go down to, I called Leon Lynch. I said, you know, they called him Daddy King, Martin Luther King's father. And he said, yeah, I can communicate with him. So he called, we went down, we met him in his church in Atlanta. And he agreed to come and speak at our last major rally. We had a couple of thousand at the last major rally. And a day or two before, I was having a staff meeting. I had a suite in a motel. That was my office. And about 11 o'clock, I got a call from my potential first son-in-law. He said, I'd like your permission to marry your daughter. This is probably out of the movies. And while I'm on the phone, the other phone rings. We had a couple of phones, and the guy said, "Daddy King's on the phone. You got to talk to him." Man, what do I do? So I called him. He said, "I'm not feeling well." He said, "I can't make it." And we went along for 5 or 10 minutes. I tried to change his mind. He said, "I'll send my right hand guy up." And I said, well, we can't force you. And he wasn't young then either. He's since passed away. And it was a big letdown for me because that was a key element. And, you know, the election looked good. But by my own practice, I wouldn't file for an election unless I felt we had an outstanding chance. I always told the workers here, we're not here to run an election. We're here to build a union, no matter how long it takes. And I do remember, because I had to take the cards to the Baltimore office. We had over 11,000 authorization cards. I had them in string, and I cut my fingers carrying them from the car to the labor board. But he sent his assistant, and he said, "What should I say?" So I said, "We'll draft some notes for you." And we did. You know, he was sincere. He was a minister. And the key was that if Daddy King was here, he would tell you to vote for the steelworkers.
Uh-huh.
And he did. He read the speech. So, that, like I said, I've had some strange experiences. My future son was on one line and King's on the other. Go ahead.
Did you take pictures of the speech?
Not in that era. No, we didn't have computers. We didn't have cameras. There's a few the few pictures there that I do recall. Somebody from the press, I was being interviewed there. There's only pictures that the union took, you know, after the campaign and that. It's unfortunate that wasn't recorded, that rally. We had a couple thousand there, and in fact we had Senator Ford from Tennessee. The top African-American senator from Tennessee speak in behalf of the Steelworkers Union. It was a long, complicated campaign, and like I said, I won't bore you with it.
Lots of unions, international unions as they call, which usually means they have some Canadian membership, or in the steelworkers' case, a lot of Canadian membership. Most have headquartered in Washington, D.C., but as I think I said before, because so much of the industry of the UAW was in Michigan, they put their headquarters in Detroit. The steelworkers, since so much of steel had been in Pennsylvania, their headquarters were in Pittsburgh.
Right.
But they had interest in lobbying, and the AFL, or AFL-CIO, had headquarters here. So part of your time
right.
was here, others was the Pittsburgh.
Go ahead.
Sorry, this question is probably...
No, don't apologize. That's what we're here for.
The labor unions dared to cross international lines, and they formed unions internationally. Do you think that employer unions ever, contemplated or thought about making or creating unions with other employers across, you know, the continents and whatnot?
Employers?
Mm-hmm.
They have unions.
Well, I guess what he's getting to what extent, this is something Steelworkers has done a little bit, but it's been a very recent.
Oh, international, I saw you.
British or
German. There's a real effort. It's a good question.
Is that what you're getting at?
Yes.
Yeah. There is.
Unions in America,
yeah.
Unions elsewhere.
Yeah,
so were they ever, you know.
There's a recognition that, it's one. We're living in one world, and we got to operate that way. The unions are starting to reach out. The steelworkers have signed a couple major alliances with a major union in England and Mexico.
Are these employer unions?
No.
No, workers unions.
The workers were uniting.
Right.
So were the employers.
Yeah, they have their associations. Manufacturer Association, Chamber of Commerce, those are their unions.
Were they ever trying to unite with other employers overseas at all?
That's a good question. That's a good. Do they collaborate, the employers, within?
Well,
of course, they own
it. Most of them are multinational,
yeah,
anyway.
They own it.
They're organized internationally. I mean,
yeah.
There aren't. I mean, any of the really big employers today may have headquarters in the States or in wherever. I mean, they're just, and it almost doesn't matter in some ways, except for paying taxes, and that becomes one of the issues about. Some companies that have their headquarters overseas to change what tax liabilities they have. But, all the big firms are really multinationals today.
But I'd say they probably collaborate with the associations in the foreign country.
Sure.
They collaborate, I'm sure.
But I was thinking you were getting at the fact that the unions are now trying to, so his union, the steelworkers, has put a lot of effort into having their union, which is mainly a Canadian-U.S. union, spend time with British and European and some Asian unions.
Yeah, they're pioneers.
To talk about that.
But I was just curious if employers are trying to follow suit and see.
My guess, they're collaborating with their associates,
yeah,
around the world. Yeah,
that
you can expect it. It's probably not public.
Yeah, obviously.
They're collaborating. John, if we're finished, I want to make one more observation.
I think we're about to take lunch break, so go ahead.
Any more questions? I want to make one point. I didn't come here to talk about myself. I come here to try to help you guys and enhance your education. The point that I want to make, and I was asking myself over and over again, what can I contribute to you here? That's what I wanted to contribute. My observation is that if I can do it, move up my career successfully, anybody can do it, and you can do it. I didn't have anything special. It probably might be genetic. I wasn't a good student because, you know, I wasn't dumb. But as I told you earlier, high school was fun and games for me. I was a good student till I got there, and then it was all fun and games. And I had a struggle to get the diploma. I told you that earlier. And when I started and took the opportunity, and I have to thank my father, even though I had very little contact with him. He raised the issue of the CIO hiring. That was the beginning. I didn't have the foundation that you guys have here, so be thankful. You're getting a good foundation. I didn't have any. It was all learn as you go and do it as you come and commit yourself. So this is the point I'm trying to leave with you. You can have a successful career, a good, happy life. Number one is patience. Number two is persistence. And number three is hard work. You know, I put in a lot of hours. I remember 2 and 3 o'clock. I used to draft and write all of the literature that I used. I did a lot of literature for Newport News, John. And when the early stage of the computer, our printer had a big box he brought down, and I would shove a handwritten leaflet into it, and it would go over the wires to Indianapolis, early printer. So what I'm saying to you guys is that there is no reason why you can't move ahead and be successful whatever your chosen career is. That's the greatness of America. The opportunity is here. I'm a living example, and I thank you very much for the opportunity, and I thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Thank you. We really appreciate, that you were willing to come down. As I mentioned, when you said about the seal,
right.
there was
okay.
There was a little gift that has this Spartan
that.
Helmet.
Right.
That's the logo for Michigan State. It's the Michigan State Spartans.
Okay. I thank you.
And so I'm sorry we don't have any nice wooden plaque.
Well, I would have asked you in advance if I wasn't retired. I used to be on my office wall.
That's very, very interesting. Thank you so much for coming over.
Yeah. Help yourself to these steel labors if you want on the way out. They're sitting right here. Or you want me to pass them around, John?
Yeah, or put them on the table and those that want to take it.
It's a good history lesson of a union. That's, you know, that's one major union of steelworkers. They did a real good job, whoever put that together.
So I think the food, where'd you go? Brian brought food, and if you guys somebody wants to start opening it up and spreading it out back there and figuring out how you want to eat, we'll just eat here and we're going to start up again at 1 o'clock. So you can eat, you can go swimming, you can whatever you want to do till 1. That was wonderful. That was great. That was a lot of fun.
Well, it was fun for me, too.
I'm glad.
I told you I was a little rusty.
I don't think you seem rusty at all.